Hi, I'm RJ O'Connell, joined by, of course, Dre Harrison and Cam Buckley. Welcome to episode 655 of Motorsport 101, where we're going to talk about the MotoGP Catalan Grand Prix. Suffice to say, Dre, before we get into all the intros of, like, you know, where you find us, because if you're a longtime listener, you probably know by now, but I mean, we just need to get into it. This was a Catalan Grand Prix that was marred by some big accidents. And I think all of us can safely say we were very lucky on Grand Prix Sunday.
Definitely. I'll spare you the usual intros and push that to the end of the show, because I think this is one of those occasions where I want to just get straight into this one, because there's a lot of explaining to do. So prepare for some exposition for the next 3 minutes, but bear with me. As RJ alluded to, there were two enormous red flag accidents on the Grand Prix on Sunday that, transcended MotoGP, became mainstream news for, sadly, bad reasons, especially from a visual standpoint. The first happened halfway through what was the original race, lap 12 of 24, halfway through. Pedro Acosta is leading at that point, ahead of Alex Marquez. Alex Marquez, I'd say, is maybe 2-3 tenths behind him directly on track. It's a pretty heated battle. It's building up. It looks like Alex Marquez is about to take the lead. All of a sudden, on lap 12 now, for those who don't know Catalunya, we're coming through turn 9, which is the last corner before F1's sector 3, MotoGP sector 4. It's the back straight under the bridge towards the stadium and grandstand section. All of a sudden, almost immediately after the exit of that right-hander at turn 9, Pedro Acosta's bike cuts out. We still aren't 100% sure as to why that was, but it suddenly loses power. Acosta immediately raises his hand, obviously to admit that there's a problem. Unfortunately, Alex Marquez is so close, there really is nothing he can do about it. There's no human reaction that can save what's about to happen here, unfortunately. And he runs straight into the back of Pedro Acosta's bike, then veers sharply to the right onto the grass and towards the outside wall on that back straight towards turn 10. Thankfully, Alex has already hopped off the bike by the time the worst of that incident happens, because for lack of a better term, Alex Marquez's bike disintegrates on impact. I've been watching MotoGP, 25 years. I have never, ever seen a bike totaled like that in that manner before, ever. It was about as violent an impact as I've ever seen in MotoGP. Bike goes up in the air, the frame and the front wheel is 200-300 feet down the road. It actually showers Fabio Di Giantonio, who was also in that leading group, in debris to the point where it actually struck his hand. He admitted after the fact he was hiding behind his race fairing because of the shower of debris that had hit him. Alex was still conscious, thankfully. He had to be taken away from the track by ambulance. We got lucky. We got extremely lucky. We found out later on that evening that it was a broken clavicle and M7 vertebra he was operated on that night at the local hospital, and he was actually out the following day in a neck brace and an arm sling for obvious reasons. Thankfully, relatively speaking, he's okay. Of course, a red flag was thrown immediately. There'll be no criticism for race direction on this one. They threw the red the moment that bike hit the wall. About half an hour later, they cleaned it up. We were told it was going to be a 13-lap restart. And then we had a classic Barcelona pinch at turn one. If you know your MotoGP, you've seen these many a time before. Johann Zarco locks his front brake. He goes into the back of Luca Marini and Pecco Bagnaia. And please forgive me for being as candid as I can be about the details for information purposes only. Zarco's leg got caught in Pecco Bagnaia's bike frame. It tore multiple ligaments out of his knee and broke the bottom of his fibula around his ankle area. He too had to be ambulanced off the track to the nearest general hospital. Again, relatively speaking, fine. What's happened now is since the time of the incident, he left General Hospital the day after, just like Alex Marquez did. He's flown back home to France to see a knee specialist. They're going to let his initial injuries heal a little bit first before they operate on the bigger injuries, i.e. the ligaments in his knee, as well as a meniscus tear, and as mentioned, a break in his fibula. For what it's worth, we did get going again about 15 minutes later for a third restart. The race was knocked down to 12 laps. We'll address that a little bit later because, quite frankly, it's not as important as what I've just mentioned. Fuck is the best way I could describe that one, to be honest with you. The Alex Marquez one is one of the most violent, hellacious crashes I've ever seen in any sport, ever. I look back on that now, and I've seen the pictures. I've seen some of the more gruesome ones that, you know, the Golden Goose provide, and I will never share those pictures because they're harrowing. I thought that man was dead. And I'm not saying that to exaggerate the situation. I'm not saying that to be dramatic. I thought that was a dead man walking right there. How he was conscious and was able to give a thumbs up to the crowd before being put in the ambulance is nothing short of a miracle.
What do we always say about these motorcycles riders that they're... I mean, MotoGP has it as part of their marketing slogan. They're wired differently. I think that's certainly true in this instance.
Yeah, to say the least. I mean, to throw your leg over one of these things is... I saw someone say...
I mean,
you have to just go forward with the belief that it's not going to happen to you. And indeed, it happened to Alex Marquez. I can only agree with Dre that I've been watching motorcycle racing. I've been around motorcycles my entire life. I've been watching motorcycle racing since before I could talk. I've never seen a bike as destroyed as Alex's bike was. That bike was stripped pretty much down to the bare frame and fuel tank.
The only thing that I think could remind, and not to like get in the whole game of comparing accidents, but remember Austria 2020?
Yeah.
How very close we were to losing Valentino Rossi, potentially others, when a motorcycle frame comes up the hairpin through the apex and all that stuff. Like I just saw the Alex Marquez crash as it happened for the first time, and I'm like, wow. He was a very, very lucky man to come away with that. Relatively unscathed. In fact, there's potential that Alex Marquez's long-term prognosis is a lot better than Johann Zarco's, even though Zarco had the less dramatic looking of the accidents, because broken bones are one thing, ligament damage for motorcycle riders is another, especially at this level.
Yeah, there are stills that I do not recommend going to find of that crash in motion. And his leg was caught up between Pecco's rear tire and his seat unit, and it just dragged him down through the gravel with him. If anything, we heard initial rumors that he had an open fracture in the femur. I actually think that probably would have been a better situation than this because, I mean, it's destroyed the structure of his knee on that leg. We won't know how okay or not okay he's going to be because he hasn't had the surgery yet. They have to let his knee, you know, heal up a little bit before they can go in and repair the ligament and cartilage damage. Take it from someone who has received this message from the doctor. You would have been better off breaking this is a scary, scary thing. Fuck.
Yeah. And I mean, as Jason points out in our supporters chat, course, if you back us on Patreon, you can be part of the supporters chat as well.
Thank you, guys.
Zarko's age, he is the oldest rider on the grid. He's 35. He turns 36 later this year, I want to say, Dre.
I believe so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not an ideal extra hurdle to have to climb when you're continuing the recovery process. I mean, Franco Morbidelli and Alex Rins were much younger when they had ligament damage in their respective crashes, and arguably they've not been the same since.
Yeah, Franco Morbidelli went from being, you know, title challenger in 2020 and legitimate win threat on a given weekend, and he just has never been the same.
Yeah, I'm Frankie Morbidelli. He tore his ACL back in 2021, just mere months after being world championship runner-up in the COVID-affected 2020 season. There's a case you could make that he's had flashes of great performances since, he's never been that 2020 Morbidelli ever again in that time span. Not to get too grim or gruesome, but general rule of thumb, a clean break is a lot more straightforward when it comes to leg injuries like that. Valentino Rossi broke his leg famously when he was in his mid-30s, when he was still at the Yamaha factory scene. He was back within 4 weeks. And ligament damage, that's a lottery. You just don't know until you're on the operating table and you're recovering. And, you know, in soccer, some guys never come back from an ACL tear the same. You know, it's very similar in that sense. So,
hi, Derek Rose fan here.
It's you never quite know, and it's every individual case is different. To review a couple of these things and do some talking about this. I mean, first and foremost, Alex Marquez's was a complete freak accident. There was nothing anybody could have done about that.
Definition of one of them racing deals. I mean, someone has a mechanical in front of you. I believe they said it was a clutch. It was a clutch issue on Bedro's bike.
Would make sense.
One of a series of KTM technical failures. All four bikes had some catastrophic mechanical issue during the Grand Prix.
Over the weekend, because Mavericks was in the sprint.
Oh, it was in the sprint.
Yeah, Mavericks was in the sprint, but Binder came off the start grid because he had a clutch problem. Enea Bastini had an engine failure early on in that first initial restart, and then Acosta's clutch is likely what caused the big one, so to speak.
It's the definition of one of those racing deals, and sometimes it just plays out really, really bad. I mean, if we were to sum up, like, this weekend on the whole, before we explore further, this was the good, the bad, and the ugly of MotoGP on full display in equal measures. And the race was a lot more bad and ugly than it was good.
I think that's more than safe to say. Unfortunately, a lot of people are very cynical about these sorts of things. I had comments on the other podcast that I host with Crash from some very smooth-brained individuals saying that Acosta could have done more, to which my response to you is, go fuck yourself. Quite frankly, you know nothing about bike racing.
There's nothing Pedro could do in that situation. He's a passenger. He was very, very lucky that the way Alex hit him, it was not center on.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunate for Marquez, that it sent him right. All it really did was kind of pick the back of Pedro's bike up and then set it back down.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen this incident before in the junior categories, Dre. That could have ended Pedro's life.
It's very similar to Jose Antonio Rueda and Noah Detweiler from Sepang in Moto3 last year, which led to both riders suffering cardiac arrests. You know, Rueda came off the better of it, which is a weird thing to say, but here we are. But we very nearly lost Noah Detweiler that weekend. And that would have been the fifth major tragedy of the last 15 years to come from the three major biking classes. Thank goodness that that never happened. And it's just a general sentiment to me that we keep dodging bullets with these bikes, and I don't know how we've gotten away with it for so long. It's
the thing about dodging bullets. Eventually, you're not going to dodge one. It feels. I almost went through the rest of Sunday morning in like a trance. And I hate to say, having watched so much motorcycle racing, I feel like I have a pretty strong stomach with some of this stuff. And that just felt just shit for the rest of that day.
Yeah. There's a point in the set list. Barcelona, the circuit itself, we are 10 years removed from the death of Louis Salom in a practice accident at Circuit de Catalunya, Barcelona. We talked a bit about the bikes, you know, our issues with the current generation of MotoGP bikes, what we feel they should change, what they we feel they haven't changed quickly enough. I'm just kind of curious, do they need to make adjustments to this track? I'm not saying cut it from the calendar. Obviously, this is like a big ticket attraction for MotoGP, but
this is literally Dorna's home round. It will never go away. They're literally down the road.
How could, is this potentially a circuit problem?
To a degree.
I think with the Acosta Marquez clash, that is again just the definition of one of those shitty racing incidents. I don't think there's anything that the track does particularly wrong there. I think turn one, the run is so long and these bikes are so powerful and they all get such great starts now because they all run whole shot ride height devices that they're all showing up at 200 plus off into one together. If anyone locks a brake in that scenario, and Johan Zarco did, there's no room for you to gather the front of that bike up. You have to release the brake. Otherwise you're going to tuck the front and go bowling. And instead of crashing out six bikes at once, he had to choose to crash out three bikes.
And as I mentioned before on this show, it's not the first. There's a reason I called it a classic Barcelona pinch point. It's not the first time we've seen this in recent years. As Cam just alluded to, 2022, and Enea Bastianini, 23, I should say, Enea Bastianini, when he locked a brake and he was on the narrow inside line into turn one, he wiped out six Ducatis that day. And amazingly, wasn't the worst accident at that corner complex in the first 10 seconds. Taka Nakagami had his head bounced off the back of Bagnaia's Ducati when he locked a brake and collected Alex Rins with him that day. Rins broke his wrist. Taka, you know, almost broke his neck in that incident. It's, as Cam alluded to, this is the third longest straight on the MotoGP calendar. But it's also one of the longest run-ups. I think it's something like 650 meters to turn one. You're in sixth gear, you're doing over 190 headed into that braking zone. If you get a full run-up on a full racing lap, well, Pedro Acosta at one point hit 363 kilometers an hour, the second highest speed ever recorded on a MotoGP bike. That is 226 miles an hour to you and me. That's how fast these bikes are now, and that's a 1 kilometer straight with a pretty fast run-up. Because the final corner in the back section has now been untouched again. We reverted back to that corner because we made a change to turn 12 in the first place when we did lose Louis Salom a decade ago. Because in the old days, that turn 12 had virtually no run-up. And what happened was when Salom crashed at that corner, the bike ricocheted off the fence and struck him. Because there was no run-up, he was hit by his own bike, and that's what killed him. And a quick tangent, which I'll get to this later, Jorge Martin had a very similar incident this weekend at turn 12, which I'll get back to. For me, multiple riders have mentioned this already. Why not just move the start-finish straight down? There's no reason why we can't put the start-finish on 200 or 300 meters further along the track. It's a simple change. And that would eliminate a lot of the pinch point problems because you're coming in at a much lower speed. Yep. They could do that tomorrow. And it would be easily done. All you're going to do is move a transponder or two around. Problem solved. You don't need a 700-meter run-up to a first turn on a bike track. Because as Cam alluded to, Everybody gets great starts now. These are the fastest accelerating bikes we've ever had. We're talking 0 to 60 in 1.8 seconds now. 1.8 with these whole shot devices.
Yeah, and they don't stop picking up speed until they have to turn.
Yeah, and we've seen it time and time again that when you're in a slipstream on a run to turn one, you lock a brake. You're a passenger at that point. It happened with Zarco over the weekend. Bez has had it happen to him a couple of times, like in Phillip Island and at Silverstone in the rain that weekend. He was leading that Grand Prix. He locked a brake down the back of the hangar straight, and he went off at 130 plus. The one at Phillip Island was over 180 when he was coming into doing that time. We've seen it so many times, and it makes it so frustrating. Because just one round ago off the back of Le Mans, we were talking about Jack Miller, who led the conversation at the safety commission meeting about banning the whole shot device for the faster race starts. Le Mans, Silverstone, Catalunya and Phillip Island were all mentioned. Banning it specifically for those races, and the factory shut him down.
Thanks. They're not going to hand over an advantage that they've worked so hard to create, and this is the last year that they can use that advantage. They're going to get all the time they can out of it. And honestly speaking, the whole shot device, banning it because the bikes are now fully dependent on it for the chassis geometry, that might actually create more problems. Like the cat is out of that bag until they can ban them wholesale going into next year.
Yeah, and like you said, there's too much internal politics for us to get to that point. There is a more radical solution. You reprofile turn one.
Well, I just heard all the F1 fans start punching air.
I don't know what all the F1 fans want to do.
Right.
This has been a constant problem in MotoGP, which, by the way, much more Spaniards actually go to compared to their F1 race. I just thought I'd point that out. Mm-hmm. That we've already reprofiled turn one before. It's now got a whole ass shortcut to go through for the exact same safety reasons we were talking about in years prior. Turn one is basically a 90 degree right hander, and you're coming into it at 200 miles an hour on a race start, 220 when
it's a funnel
on a full racing lap. It's, you know what it is? As Lewis Duncan pointed out to me on Crash's show, it's Misano, but at twice the entry speed.
Well, that seems smart.
So what would your suggestion of how to reprofile that turn one to turn two complex?
You cut turn one and two entirely, and then you funnel it in towards turn three. It's a quicker corner, but it's a bigger uphill safety. It's an uphill braking zone. It would slow the bikes down a little bit quicker. And it would be a lot like Qatar in MotoGP. That's also quite a long run-up and quite a long main straight. But turn one, you can take multiple lines. You don't have to pin it on the apex. It's a long,
full-blown, you know,
sweeping corner.
Yeah, you prevent it from being a full-blown, hunkered-down braking zone and turn it into more of a sweeper. You might take one of the problem with that, which I think is an entirely valid way to do it, is then that's like the one overtaking opportunity on this track, more or less done.
I can live with that.
Yeah.
I've seen
what I just saw.
I've seen too many of these Barcelona pinch point turn one accidents where I'm like, you know what, for the greater good, at the bare minimum, resurface the damn track. It's been too goddamn long. It's been fucking years of this. And the riders, again, valid in their complaints when they say it's like riding on ice at Catalunya, because that tarmac is like 20 years old at this point. Resurface the darn track. Give the riders a bit more grip to play with. That would help.
That should create some overtaking opportunities, honestly.
Yeah. Like, and look,
people take different lines.
In Barcelona's defense, and I will give them this, they have always been flexible. They've always been prepared to make the big change for the greater good. As mentioned, turn 13 is now very different. We had the F1 extra chicane added in for a few years to reduce speeds. they reprofiled turn 10 in the past to make it tighter, to hopefully make it more of a passing opportunity, and it has been in more recent years. Like, I'll give Barcelona this, they've always been prepared to listen, and they will put their money where their mouth is. They're one of the better promoted tracks on the calendar in that regard. They have done what there's needed to be done without fuss or complaint. It's now time for them to get their checkbooks out and get to work, because there are changes they can make. And I don't like the fact we're in a sporting situation where we have to see two dudes leave the track in an ambulance before we're having to have these conversations. Yep. The riders knew all this. The riders have known all this before. And yet it takes Alex Marquez plowing towards an inside wall and Johann Zarco's leg being caught in a bike for us to have these chats. We can avoid this.
And on a weekend
why
as well.
Why is motorsports so inactive when it comes to this? That's what frustrates me about it as a fan.
It's a very reactionary business, which is the one thing we always regret. You know, these big changes come in reaction to something rather than being proactive. It's always been kind of the nature of the beast, and it's always something you just got to kind of learn to be less uncomfortable with. And as well, you touched on this earlier, Jorge Martin picked up a concussion early on in the race weekend. He then crashed another two times. And the general reaction coming out of all this was, why didn't MotoGP just park him for the weekend the first time he crashed and pick up that concussion?
Dude, fucking, they had a doctor overseeing him for the remainder of the weekend.
Dr. Charter, their main Charter medical in the garage. Doctor.
And still would not pull him from this race while he dumped bike after bike after bike and then got dumped in the race, because how the fuck did Raul Fernandez not get penalized for that crash?
Goodness knows. It's also worth pointing out he crashed in the shortened open test the day afterwards as well. Had to go to hospital for a once over. Thankfully, he's fine. No open fractures or anything like that. But if you've been keeping score at home, that is 6 crashes in 4 days.
Yeah, not ideal. And again, this is Martin, who had just won his first Grand Prix with Aprilia, had just moved back into title contention. It seems like everything is starting to turn around after a 2025 season for Pell. And then this weekend just kind of punctured the balloon, took all the air out of that momentum.
I'll say this. And I know Cam will back me up on this because we're very similar minded on this. I know it's embryonic, but we now know enough about head injuries. In fact, let's be frank, CTE has been kind of turned into an insult for people that are a bit stupid in mainstream culture, because we now know more about head injuries than we ever have, and we will only continue to know more. This is still quite an embryonic field of study. In the grand scheme of things, we're still doing like medical reviews and studies into things like, for, I don't know if you guys know this, for example, in football, not American football, soccer, where I think it's Chris Sutton, who's the quite famous Scottish footballer whose dad sadly has dementia or had dementia. He's been leading an open study into the effect of heading the ball in soccer and realizing that, hey, you're 4 to 5 times more likely to suffer a debilitating disease like Alzheimer's.
I've seen people come down with ALS from it.
An ALS as a result of prolonged heading of the football, because a football, when inflated, is heavy. And you're hitting your head with it constantly. And you've been doing that for an entire career. Same with bobsleigh racing. The bumps in an ice track can cause micro concussions because of how bumpy you are, and the fact that at the peak you're going over 80 miles an hour on ice. It's inherently dangerous. So my point I'm getting at here is that MotoGP no longer has the excuse of being able to plead ignorance more than ever. And me and him don't see eye to eye on a lot of bullshit. But I'll give Patterson this. He's been the main guy voicing concern about concussions in bike racing for years. And he's bang on in that regard, that now the global consensus when it comes to sport is, if in doubt, sit them out. That is the FIM's policy. It's the Premier League's policy when it comes to football. It's right. Now a pretty uniform stance across sports at this point, that if you see someone with concussion-like symptoms, you sit them.
Yeah.
Jorge Martin was allowed to continue in a race weekend where he showed concussion-like symptoms in the immediate aftermath of his crash, and crashed four more times over the course of the weekend, and once again in an open test.
Yeah, because if he feels fine, he's not going to pull himself. He's, at that time, in contention to further his lead in the World Championship. You think he's going to pull himself out if he feels like he could ride? No.
Of course not.
Well, and the sport refuses to protect riders against themselves. We saw that with Honda refusing to sit out Marc Marquez when he broke his arm and he had to pin back together 2 days later.
Yeah. The sport does not want, and I need to point out one more time here, this is not a Liberty Media thing, because I know people are very quick to pin the blame on them because they're not popular.
We've been yapping about this for years.
This is a decade-old problem. This is not new. This is something that we've been talking about for a long, long time. I remember Dennis Onchu being knocked out when he had a crash at Misano. I remember Danilo Petrucci, who, when he rode at Aragon for Pramac in 2019, when he openly admitted after FP3 he didn't know where he was on track, but he was allowed to ride a 300-horsepower motorcycle like nothing had happened. You know, I can name countless biking incidents where concussions have either been ignored, or arguably even worse, acknowledged and have let them ride on with it anyway.
That's what this was.
It's completely unacceptable. You are not fit to call yourself a world sporting championship if you're letting your athletes compete with head injuries. I'm sorry. It's like, I don't care if Liberty are so concerned, or whoever else is running this sport is so concerned about empty bikes on the grid or empty garages. By comparison, if Jorge Martin was a rugby player, and that's what happened to him, which they now have sensors in their mouth guards to be able to detect head injuries, because again, rugby is the world leader when it comes to head injuries, you'd be pulled off the pitch immediately, and then you'd be told you're sitting out for 3 weeks. It's now a mandatory 21-day rest period if you are now diagnosed with a concussion. And I think they're the only major sport in the world that has that policy. That's the standard. I don't care if it means a championship-level rider has to miss a round or two. I would much rather see that than them risking second impact syndrome, which can kill.
For sure. One other question that's come up out of all this, I mean, this has been kind of a bleak weekend so far. We'll talk about the other stuff, but if this doesn't get the riders to unionize and form a proper, more than just a riders association, but a proper riders union, what will?
Someone being killed.
Having to bury a myth.
Yeah. And even then, I don't know if I necessarily trust them to band together like that. Riders will band together to a point, but it's, I don't know. I have to be comfortable with saying I don't know what it's going to take, because this was a race that multiple riders put their hand up afterwards. It's like, why did we just go do that? We had the incident with Detweiler last year where he died trackside and had to be revived. And that was kept from the riders so the weekend could continue.
Riders that, conscious.
Yeah. Which we know was inaccurate. He was not. He had suffered a cardiac arrest. Yeah. I don't know what it's going to take. And this I don't think I want to.
Yeah, this is the sported environment that we're in. And look, I pull one out for Matt Oxley, one of the best journos in the business, two wheels or four. He is someone that has ridden the Isle of Man TT, won class races at the Isle of Man TT. The man has risked his life and was prepared to make the ultimate sacrifice in the ultimate bike race in order to make this point.
He speaks on this from a place of knowing. He knows more than just about any of us can.
He's forgotten more than I know about bike racing, and he has screamed from the heavens for years. The riders need to lawyer up and form a union so that, because quite frankly, for the riders' own sake, they need to union up and organize. They need a voice on the table, a seat on the table for them, because they're the ones that are the guinea pigs. They're the ones that are being told to jump through these hoops of fire. They're the ones that are risking their lives every time they hop over a fuel tank on one of these machines and race it. And yet they get very little say in how this sport is run. It broke my heart hearing about 10 years ago when Louis Salon passed away. This is a quick side story here. I distinctively remember one man in particular's frustration at the situation. It was Bradley Smith. Remember Bradley Smith?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Bradley Smith was a damn good bike rider.
Yeah.
Podium finisher at Misano in 2015. One of the finest Brits we've had in modern times. He was also the head delegate for the Safety Commission when he was a bike rider. And one of the most eloquent and intelligent riders on the grid. I remember him blowing his top at TNT Sports out of sheer frustration because no one rode up to the Safety Commission meetings. And then the moment that Louis Salon passed away, everybody wants to start talking about safety. And Smith was the first person to point out Valentino Rossi's hypocrisy, talking about wanting to change the layout when he said, well, you've never been in these meetings, so why do you want to talk now? And I think that's precisely the problem. And as I talk about this man more and more, the more I come to respect him. Pedro Acosta, who's got one of the wisest heads on his shoulders for a 22-year-old I've ever seen in motorsport, was like, I don't think we'll ever get a union because these guys are too egocentric.
That's right. They're yeah. very self-driven. It's an individual-driven sport.
It's the belief it's not going to happen to me, so why do we need one?
It's the and point. He made the point. Yeah, yeah. Sorry to cut you, Cam. He yeah. made the point, right, that he didn't want to do the third stop. He was like, can we go home after the second red flag? He didn't want to race again. And this was the biggest opportunity Acosta has had to win a MotoGP race in his career. And he was prepared to sit it out. But he said in the back of his head, I've got to. Because I know Marco Bezzecchi is competing for a championship and he's going to take advantage of the situation and he's going to want to race. And mm-hmm. He wasn't directly calling out Bez, but he was using Bez as an example because of his world championship lead, because of the fact he's competing for a championship. And he's not going to be prepared to leave those points on the table when he sees an opportunity. And he's completely right.
Yeah, that's what you're paid to go do, is go take that extra step, leave nothing on the table, take every chance. And that is why I don't know what it's going to take for the riders to, you know, plant their feet and take that final step towards a riders union, because there will always be someone who believes that they can take advantage of there not being one.
It's an incredibly competitive sport. They are a band of brothers, and to highlight an example of that, when Zarco was down screaming in pain because of the injury that he had just suffered, Luca Marini and Pecco Bagnaia stayed with him until the medical crew got there. They are a band of brothers. They look out for each other. I've never seen so many messages of just sympathy, regret, and the amount of riders that said we shouldn't have restarted this race. Alex Rins did, and he said it broke his heart because that was his ex-teammate. They were teammates at LCR, yeah. Him and Alex. It broke his heart seeing him on the ground as he was riding past. He was at the back of the field as that incident had happened, and he sees Alex prone on the ground with his bike in shreds. They didn't want to restart this race, but the show had to go on. And
there you go, that going back to it. The sport refuses to be proactive. It's all reaction when something like this happens. and the reaction feels like it's never really strong enough, because voices of dissent, you know, pipe up from the peanut gallery to go, well, shut up and race. Like, we can race. This is the most dangerous of all motor racing in the world. I see no point in withholding that from general discussion.
No.
It's never going to be safe. There is no scenario where throwing your leg over a 300 horsepower carbon piss missile is ever going to be safe. But we can do better.
David Emmett summed it up beautifully in his post on MotoMatters.com. I've said it before. He's a fantastic writer, and he summed it up best. There is nothing you can do about a 157 kilo package of metal hurtling towards you. The best we can do is give us the best possible chance. And the sport is not doing that at this level right now. And as we said it during Brazil, and I will say it again here, this is not how a world championship should be conducted. And before we move on and talk about the final restart, I wanted to make this point. We need to drop this culture of the show must go on. I was streaming this race in real time as it happened with a room of about 15 people. And I openly said after the Zarco crash, I'd like to go home. I've seen enough. I would have happily taken half points for 11 completed laps and we all just get the fuck out of here. But I also know in the back of my head that was never going to happen. I made this point during our Le Mans episode that the regulations are going even further in towards protecting the premier class. I talked about it for those who didn't see the Le Mans episode real quick as an example. Because the whole weekend was dry up until Sunday, and Sunday it rained, they have a new rule, which means if it's wet on Sunday, they will let everybody get 10 minutes of extra sighting laps in. They'll shave a third off the race because they know it's going to be at a slower race pace because it's in the rain, to protect the TV window for the premier class. They want that half an hour, 45 minute, 1 hour pre-show. They want their half an hour long post-show. Protect the TV window at all costs. The general consensus that I saw was that the riders did not want to continue after Zarco's accident. Zarco regrets taking that restart before his knee exploded, you know?
So all he could think about was the disaster that just happened on the other side of the circuit.
Echo Bagnaia said he shouldn't have taken the restart. Luca Marini said he was sick in his stomach afterwards.
Luca Marini was
devastated.
Like, he was in shock. For, you know, the entire post race, he looked like he was in a trance. He feeling like a bunch of us did watching, like just a bad feeling in the pit of your stomach. If you are the pinnacle of motorcycle racing, and you are, we expect more. We should expect more.
We don't have that figure. And we don't have someone. We don't have a galvanizing force. I mean, Vic makes a great point, F1-wise, in the chat. We haven't got a Niki Lauda or a Jackie Stewart, someone that's prepared to defy the odds, defy the lawmakers, and stand up and say, this is not acceptable. We need to do something about this. Because every time we get a near miss like this one, like with Guyana, like with Detweiler and Rueda and Sepang, they always concede. And the show must go on. We had a full race weekend, despite the fact that two Moto3 riders had a heart attack that morning. And arguably should have died. Did die, technically.
It's always reactive, Dre. It's always after the fact. It's all, we shouldn't have restarted. Like, were you saying this beforehand?
What's it going to take? Is it going to take a dead colleague? Is that going to be enough? I hate to even entertain that possibility, but I can't at this point. We've come as close to without crossing that line multiple times since we lost Salom at this weekend 10 years ago. We lost Troy and Thomas Harwood doing that. We lost Jason Dupasquier in similar circumstances since then. Is it going to take another? Is it going to take somebody burying their friend?
I don't even know if that's going to be enough.
I was here after we lost Marco. I'm not sure what it's going to take. That's the terrifying part of this. That's what it boils down to at the end of the day. Someone needs to stand up to the sport itself and say no. The riders need to put their foot down and say no. But we need a galvanizing force, but I'm not sure it exists in that paddock. And that is sad. Because they could do so much more with a riders' union. And it's been time, it's been far too long since we should have had one of them. And I don't think it's going to happen. I think Pedro's bang on. I think there's too many egos. I think there's too much power and politics and influence at play to ever get all 22 riders on board for something like that. And as a result, that's part of the reason why we have weekends like this, where we have to rip off the Band-Aid and have another difficult conversation about it, because this is going to keep happening. And I'm not sure what's going to take.
It's going to keep happening until one of those bullets lands. And I don't want to have my eyes on the screen when it does.
Me neither.
For what it's worth, we did get that second restart. Acosta took the early lead. He held off Yoan Mir's Honda, but Fabio Di Giantonio saved his tires for a late attack. He got past Mir. He got past Acosta. Fabio Di Giantonio wins. Yoan Mir was second, and then he wasn't. A lot of guys got dinged for tire pressures after the race, most of them Mir. But Fabio Di Giantonio, once again, the top Ducati rider, in a world where we don't know how long we're going to be without the Marquez brothers. We don't know how long our bikes is going to be on indefinite hiatus. So Digio, to his credit, has been very, very solid this year.
It's the best he's ridden since the last time his free agent status was up in the air in 2023 when he won in Qatar. That was beating Pecco Bagnaia, who was about to win his first, his first world championship. Or second, I should say, actually. It's fair play to Digio. He rode that situation. He recognized the situation and he judged it perfectly. He knew that Acosta was going at 11 temps. He was destroying his tires to try and keep that lead. Props to Yoan Mir. Rode a fantastic race. And that man really did deserve a bone this weekend. I'll give him this. I know we've been the first to rag on him many a time on this show. He was wiped out in the...
by 0.004 bar on the tire pressure rule.
That would have been his best finish since 2020. He ends up 13 because, you know, it's a 16-second time penalty if you go over the limit on tire pressures in a Grand Prix scenario. He deserved that second place. He rode his nuts off in that race.
Honda decade of humiliation in MotoGP continues. Even when it's all right, it ends up being terrible.
And he rode his nuts.
And he got wiped out in the sprint through Digia. Not even trying to go for a move, just going bowling off the side of Digia's bike. And could have legitimately won this race, but was faster in all the wrong spots to go and win and actually pass Acosta. Acosta's breaking point was like a whole 5 meters later into turn one every lap. And the Honda still couldn't get stopped into one. It was all the speed through the turns and not being bad on the straight. The brakes were shit.
Yeah, you could see Mir making shapes on that turn one braking zone because he was on the limit of how late he could brake on that Honda, and it wasn't enough because when the KTM was quick, Acosta was able to brake 5 meters later. He only got him on the final lap of the race, and that's only because Acosta had no rear grip left whatsoever. He could not get the bike stopped. He almost lost it at turn three the long sweeping right-hander and actually open the door for Fermín Aldeguer, who, by the way, the quietest second place, maybe in MotoGP history post-penalty.
Does nothing.
Fermín Aldeguer was second.
Lance second. Good to see him back. He was solid this weekend.
Yeah.
Grazini in general was solid until, you know, a Ducati got exploded on the backstretch.
Six riders were investigated for tire pressures after the race. Five of them received penalties. Rins, Mir, Toprak, Raul Fernandez was up there. The only one who didn't was Pecco Bagnaia, who had a leaking rim, so he had the mitigating circumstance to not receive a penalty. And with it, third place and Ducati's first factory podium in 11 Grand Prix.
And a Ducati sweep of the podium in general in the Grand Prix. I mean...
Yeah, Aprilia got backhanded this weekend.
It goes to show you that maybe they don't have all the answers yet. I thought this was going to be a dominant Aprilia round, given Aprilia typically loves low grip. And yet...
And yet they got destroyed all weekend. The only real exception, because Bez just wasn't really at the races. Not much in the sprint, not much in qualifying, not... that much in the, he was spared blushes in the Grand Prix by all the crazy shit that occurred in front of him.
Jammy fourth place result of
onions on the grill, caramelized. Yeah, that caramelized. Level jammy.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, that Pez's best result in Catalunya in a Grand Prix until this weekend was ninth. He's never liked Catalunya. And
conversely, Jorge Martin, despite the concussion, second place on the restart, and Raul Fernandez just cleaned him the fuck out.
Turn five, where he actually made a couple of decent passes in the earlier restarts, and that's not a place I would attempt to pass unless I was feeling very brave.
Knock Lappy.
There's a reason why I call turn five a corner of poor judgment. That was poor judgment. And honestly, in this Simon Crafer, why the fuck was that not a penalty?
Especially because another Aprilia got involved in an incident where Pedro Acosta led all of this race until he didn't. And then he got nothing. Ayagura, I love you. Ayagura surprise. Looked great all weekend.
That was a very bad Agüero surprise.
No, you are not Valentino Rossi in his prime, my friend.
Man tried
it up the inside on the last turn and sent Pedro Acosta into... Oh my god. It was so bad.
What I'm saying is that he's lucky the one man he wiped out is the most understanding man in the world in Pedro Acosta, because apparently Pedro told the zone afterwards, listen, I'll give him this. He waited outside my room for half an hour while I was getting undressed, and he went up and profusely apologized, and he said, listen, I respect any man that's prepared to bow his head and wait that long. Acosta, there's nothing else. Pedro's all that he's usually understands. Shit happens in racing. And he just wasn't mad about it, which was very sporting of him, but he was wiped out at the final corner. That, I mean, Agüero got a 3 second time penalty. It was a long lap converted because obviously it was the final lap of the race. So he got a 3 second time penalty for that move and knocked him. I believe he was fourth on the road. He dropped to ninth, but then got back up to eighth again because of Mir's time penalty over pressures. It's a weird finishing lineup.
Every bit of good, bad, and ugly all rolled into one. We had tire pressures. We had Knock Wappy. We had the aforementioned incidents. We had Fabio Quartararo ripping a top five out of that horrible motorcycle.
He's had three top sixes in the last four, if you include the sprints. Fabio's on fire at the moment. Like, seriously.
Why won't you rev?
I don't understand it. I mean, also, I don't know if you saw it, when Fernandez, I mean, this is going to be another Aprilia-based problem. When Fernandez wiped out Martin, Massimo Rivola was pissed. He walked next door to Trackhouse's garage, and Davide Brivio was standing right there, and Rivio was like,
Davide Brivio, we might add.
Yes, Davide Brivio is leaving Trackhouse at the end of the season. That was confirmed during the weekend. Almost certainly will be going to HRC to return home, basically to run that team instead. Alberto Puig announced he's also stepping down from his role as team manager at the end of the year. He's going to be taking on more of an advisory role. But Rivola walked up to the Trackhouse garage, saw Davide, and was like, "What the fuck was that?" And Davide's like, "Well, what do you want me to do about it?" You know, it was just,
"I'm not on the bike."
Exactly. And when Jorge Martin got back to the garage, he actually shoved his team manager, Paolo Bonera, that went semi-viral because it's like, well, look, let's put it this way, right? I'm not one of these pedantic people. Jorge Martin profusely apologized afterwards when he calmed down and he wasn't in a moment of adrenaline-induced rage. But there's a lot of people in motorsport that absolutely do not accept when people throw hands. People hate it when they throw hands in motorsport about how disrespectful it apparently is.
It's a good thing I grew up on NASCAR. It was like a semi-weekly occurrence.
It really depends on the motorsport in which you come up through.
Yeah.
What's the Bomani catchphrase, RJ?
You can fight if the motorsport is right. Although that catchphrase doesn't always work because they're all the right sports predominantly.
One of my earliest racing memories is watching Kevin Harvick leaping over cars to go get to Ricky Rudd.
It's glorious. No, that is, I mean, Martin again apologized after the fact, but he was just in such a fit of rage that Fernandez had taken him out. Like, I don't think he was necessarily mad he was taken out. I think it was the fact it was a fellow Aprilia that wiped him out. Because apparently Aprilia's told Martin and Bezzecchi, listen, do what you got to do, just don't hit each other on track, is what they've basically told them. Fight to your heart's content.
Yeah, like rule number two of motorsport, don't hit your teammate.
Just don't wipe each other out. Otherwise, fight as hard as you need to. We will not intervene, basically. So for him to be wiped out by a fellow Aprilia is a tough break, but you've also got to understand there's no reason why Trackhouse can't compete for this championship. It's, you know,
It feels like they keep kind of false starting on it. We're like, we're kind of trading which Trackhouse is going to have a good weekend, whether it's going to be Fernandez or Iagura. But Iagura was at stages of this race. He was the fastest rider on track. He was very, very quick this weekend.
Got up to that lead group. I mean, he started originally 18th on the grid. If Agura's got a problem, is that he can't qualify. He's a shit qualifier, but he makes so much ground in race trim that he's insane. He was within a half a second of the win again in the final lap. But of course made a mistake and wiped out Acosta, and it derailed what would have been a really good result. Would have been another top four finish. Instead, it's eighth, which just feels unnecessary. I mean, wild weekend. In the end, it just to break this down, because I don't normally do post-race results on the pod, but after all the penalties in the end, Digia wins from Aldeguer and Bagnaia, which again, Ducati lock out the podium with three different teams, which is wild to say the least. Bez was fourth, Quartararo fifth, Marini's best result of the year in sixth, Brad Binder was seventh, Iagura eighth, Diogo Moreira gets his first top 10 in ninth, Morbidelli 10th, ahead of Vinales. Augusto Fernandez, who was wild card in this weekend, got 4 points in 12th, ahead of Mir post-penalty, Rins post-penalty, Miller post-penalty gets the last point in 15th, and Toprak post-penalty in 16th. They were all penalized for tire pressures. Get rid of this rule for restarts. Get rid of it. Yeah. Why?
Yeah. And if you're one of those riders that capitalized on those penalties, take it to the bank. Chances are you probably needed that result to help turn your season around.
First real result of the season for both Bagnaia and Aldeguer on the podium.
Augusto Fernandez now has more points than Jack Miller. Yeah.
I'm going to throw up.
Man. MotoGP will be back next weekend. One of the big ones. It's the Italian Grand Prix at Mugello. Oh, one of the red ribbon events of the year. And, well, who knows what we're going to get. We might have one Marquez brother back by then. We'll have to wait and see. Gianni couldn't confirm over the weekend whether Mark Marquez will be back from Mugello or not. Quite frankly, I think he had more important things to attend to over the course of the weekend, quite frankly. But, yeah, we'll review that when it happens in a week and a half's time. Places you can find us real quick, youtube.com, Motorsport 101. Same for Facebook, Twitter, Motorsport_101. We're all on Blue Sky. My name, Dre Harrison. His name, RJ O'Connell. See Buckley917 for Cam. If you want video highlights of the show, Motorsport 101 pod on Instagram and 101 podcast on TikTok. And yeah, our website, motorsport101.com, for all of my thoughts on this race weekend in a little bit more detail and with slightly less anger. Without further ado, we'll be back to preview and talk about the Indy 500, the story so far, next time around. Until then, I've been Dre Harrison, they've been Cam Buckley and RJ O'Connell. Thank you very much for watching, and all the very best to Alex Marquez and Johann Zarco. Take care.
Get well soon, y'all.